Good afternoon and welcome to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to listen to conversations I had last spring with two award-winning authors, Ruth Franklin and Amor Towles. Towles is the author of A Gentleman in Moscow and two other novels. His latest book is a compelling collection of short stories and a novella called Table for Two. Amor Towles will join me a little later in the program, but first, I was delighted to welcome Ruth Franklin to the show. She's a journalist and author whose biography of the writer Shirley Jackson won the National Book Critics Circle Award 9 years ago. Her latest book is another biography about Anne Frank. It is wholly original and striking, particularly in its form and structure. The first half of the book sheds new insight on the somewhat familiar terrain of the Frank family's more than 2-year attempt to hide from the Nazis in Amsterdam in the early years of the Second World War. The second half is devoted to the history and evolution of the famous diary that Anne kept during her time in hiding, and how Anne's place in the public imagination transformed her from teenage diarist to international icon. I spoke with Ruth Franklin on the Jewish observance of Yom HaShoah, the commemoration of the Holocaust, prior to the latest developments in Gaza. Ruth Franklin grew up in Baltimore and graduated from the Park School. She's a literary critic and former editor at the New Republic, and she teaches nonfiction writing in the MFA program at Columbia University. The new book is called The Many Lives of Anne Frank. Ruth Franklin joined us on Zoom from Brooklyn, New York. So this really is kind of almost a double biography. It's a biography of Anne Frank, and it's also a biography of this famous book that she wrote, this famous diary. When you went to discover more about Anne Frank, a very familiar figure, you know, to a lot of people, what did you hope to find? What were we missing about the details of her life? And then we'll talk about what we might have been missing about the details of the diary.
Well, you know, I think it's so hard to separate, of course, her life from the diary. But, you know, growing up in Baltimore, as you said, of course, I read the diary of Anne Frank, as so many girls, Jewish girls, American girls, you know, people around the world do. And it struck me, you know, a little bit later in the 90s and early 2000s, I started hearing about missing pages from the diary being discovered and published. And, you know, this was just not part of the way we were told to understand the diary when, you know, when I was growing up, when we were first reading it. And I started becoming very, very curious just about the publication history of this book and what Anne had intended by writing it and revising it with the hope to publish it.
There have been many controversial adaptations of the diary, movies, plays, works of art. You talk a lot about them in the book. What have they meant overall for our understanding of Anne? And have they clouded it? Have they led us down paths that appear to be understanding Anne when in fact we're misunderstanding Anne Frank?
Well, you know, it's such a complicated story. The most famous and perhaps the most influential, the first of those adaptations was the Broadway play that appeared in the late 50s and the movie that was made from it that followed. And people have often accused those adaptations of what these people say, de-Judaizing Anne Frank, downplaying her Jewish identity to make her story feel more universal. And, you know, one of the many surprises that I found while researching my book is that tension between the desire for Anne's story to be, you know, a specific story about a Jewish girl who suffered persecution by the Nazis, but also to be a universal story that can be, you know, approached and understood and sympathized with by people all around the world. That tension was part of the very earliest ways that the diary was framed for publication, including by her father, Otto Frank, who said from the start both that he didn't see Anne's diary as a Jewish book, that it was a book for everyone, he said. He really had a vision that it would be understood and appreciated by people all around the world as a document that fought against persecution. But at the same time that he wanted it to be understood as a Jewish book so that it could work against anti-Semitism. And so those two aspects of it have sort of always been in tension, and that's something we see play out over the decades in many of the different adaptations.
When you encountered it as a young Jewish girl, do you remember how old you were when you read it first time?
I was around 8 years old when I read it for the
8 years
first
old. So you were really little, you know. You were precocious as a reader back in those days. And as you reread it and research it and, you know, encounter it as an adult, how has your connection, your personal emotional connection to it changed and evolved since you were a little girl?
So, reading it as a girl, I think we tend to identify with Anne, whatever that means, but to appreciate her description of herself growing up, her going through puberty, her first love, all the things about her story that are so relatable. Coming back to the diary, before I started researching this book, I hadn't read it, I think, since I was a child or a teenager. And reading it as a parent, I found, is a very, very different experience. One of my children was 13 when I started working on this book, which is the same age that Anne was when she received the diary for a birthday present. And it was, just impossible for me not to be thinking of this book through the perspective of a parent. And that gave me so much more of an appreciation for Otto Frank. And the incredibly important role that he played in bringing this book to the world. He's been kind of demonized by readers of the diary who know that he played a role in editing it, but don't quite know what that role was. And he's been called Anne's censor. He's been accused of taking out her criticisms of her mother or her thoughts about her growing body. And I found in, really carefully comparing the different versions of the diary, I found that that just wasn't true, and that in many cases it was Otto Frank who was putting back material that Anne herself had taken out of the version that she had hoped to publish. But more than that, I came to respect, first of all, to feel great sympathy for him as the only survivor of all of the eight people who were in hiding in the annex, his family, the Van Pels family, who were his colleagues, and also Fritz Pfeffer, a dentist who they took into their hiding place. He was the only one to return from the camps. All the others died. And to just think about the devastation that he must have felt losing his family, his daughters, and then being presented by his former secretary, Miep Gies, who went to the annex after the Nazis had raided it and literally picked up Anne's diary off the floor and kept it in her desk, hoping that Anne would return. And then, after it was clear that Anne had died, she presented that to Otto, saying, "This is your daughter's legacy to you." Just to imagine as a parent what that must have felt like, and then, the incredible contribution he made by publishing this book for the world to read. I have so much respect for Otto Frank.
Yeah, it's just an incredible thing to imagine, both as a parent and just as a person. The book is The Many Lives of Anne Frank. The author is my guest, Ruth Franklin. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. You mentioned the versions of the diary. Why are there versions? Talk us through what might have been different from what Anne originally wrote and what ended up eventually being published by Otto and others.
I think this is a really fascinating aspect of the diary's evolution. So, in late March 1944, after Anne had been in hiding for almost 2 years, she heard a minister from the Dutch government in exile give a speech on the radio in which he called for citizens to preserve their documents from the war years for a future national archive. And I find the words of this so moving. He said that history can't be written on the basis of official documents alone, and that to fully tell the story of what they, as the Dutch people, had experienced during the war, they needed private documents like letters and diaries. And Anne writes in her diary that when the other residents heard this, because they'd all gather around the radio to listen together at night, when they heard this, they all made a rush for her diary. they knew that she had just such a document that was being called for this future archive. But it's clear as she was looking it over, because that is something that she often did. We see that she left notes to herself in her diary where she would comment on something she had previously written. As she was looking it over, it seems that she realized that the diary as she had written it wasn't appropriate for this kind of public audience. It wouldn't work for that purpose. She had written it as a private diary, of course. You know, it had all kinds of personal things in it, you know, from
And she was a
her.
teenage girl. She wrote about teenage girl stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, including she wrote about her huge crush on the boy who was in hiding with her, Peter Van Pels. And that was one of the things that Anne actually took out of her diary when she went back and revised it for publication. So her revisions were actually twofold. On the one hand, she put in more information about her persecution by the Nazis, about the circumstances in general of the Holocaust in the Netherlands. But she also took out information that she seems to have thought was too personal to publish, including her romance with Peter Van Pels. And it's her father who we have to thank for putting that story back in.
How would you assess, because you did a lot of research and you wrote a lot about the history of the Holocaust in the Netherlands, where she was. So this annex that they were hiding in was in Amsterdam. It remains as a museum to this day. People visit it from all over the world. The Dutch government that and the mood during the Second World War. In the Netherlands. How would you describe it? How did it differ from other places in Europe? And how did that influence the reception of the diary among the Dutch, you know, when this came out?
Yeah, this is a very complicated story. So, you know, the Nazis invaded the Netherlands in May 1940 and occupied it after only a few days of fighting. The Queen abdicated to England and leaving in place this Dutch civil administration. And so this is a topic of debate among historians up till today, is the extent to which the Dutch themselves can be implicated in what happened to the Jews of the Netherlands. The Netherlands had the highest Dutch rate for their Jewish population of any country in Western Europe. Around 75% of Jews in the Netherlands were killed by the Nazis. You may be wondering why I'm saying Jews in the Netherlands rather than Dutch Jews, and it's because many of those Jews were refugees from Germany, like the Franks, who came from
Yeah,
France.
Anne was born in Frankfurt, Germany. Yeah.
That's right. And she came to the Netherlands as a refugee with her family in 1934 after Hitler came to power. And it during the 30s, right up until 1940, when the Nazis invaded, many Jews came as refugees from Germany and settled in the same neighborhood in South Amsterdam that Anne and her family lived in. And, you know, I think the Dutch attitude towards all these German Jewish refugees was a little bit complicated. You know, like many Western European populations, they had a history of tolerance, but they also had a lot of anti-Semitism. And we see that manifesting also, you know, sadly, after the Jews returned from the few survivors, the 25% who survived, returned from the camps or came out of hiding, they weren't always welcomed by their Dutch neighbors. And, you know, it's a sad and complicated story that I think the Dutch are still reckoning with today.
Yeah, you write about how they often had time or trouble reclaiming things that had been stolen, property, that kind of stuff. They didn't get any help from the civil authorities to get resettled, and you know, even after this trauma they had been through, didn't get a whole lot of help that they certainly could have. You've written about the Holocaust before. It's not a book that I've read, but I've read about it, about the representations of the Holocaust. And you make the argument that it's to write fiction about the Holocaust is okay. I mean, there's a place for that. Anne finds herself as a character in all sorts of fictional adaptations and fictional stories. What has that done? There's a famous novel by Philip Roth, the title of which is escaping. Oh, The Ghost Rider, maybe, is that what it's called? And
Yes.
Anne's in there as a character. When fiction writers insert her in their fabulism, what does that do to our understanding of Anne?
That's right. There's a whole genre of these books, and I devote a chapter of my book about Anne Frank to them. I just sort of couldn't believe that there were so many cases in which she appears, counterhistorically as a surviving figure, a fictional figure, including, of course, the one you mentioned, The Ghost Rider by Philip Roth, in which I think is a useful example because it illustrates the extent to which when Anne appears in these books, she's not herself. She's a fictional figure who survived, but it's not about Anne Frank. It's about how these writers perceive her, and as a mirror for their own preoccupations. And we see that in The Ghost Rider, in which there's like the character Nathan Zuckerman, who is a stand-in for the young Philip Roth, encounters at the home of another writer this fetching young co-ed college student who he develops a whole fantasy about, that she's in fact Anne Frank, having survived the Holocaust, and she's living clandestinely in the US. And he develops this whole fantasy that he's going to fall in love with her and marry her as sort of the ultimate comeback to his parents and others in the American Jewish community who are criticizing him for the kind of fiction that he's writing. This Philip Roth's very satirical, biting, uncomplimentary fiction about Jews. And so he imagines, what could he do to redeem himself in the eyes of these people, so much as even as marrying Anne Frank is sort of the ultimate way in which Philip Roth could say, look, I am a real, I am a good Jew after all, because look who picked me. And I think in that we see a lot of anxiety of the Americans in the 1950s about the Holocaust, about the survivors and the role that they played in our culture. But also about American Jewish guilt, about having experienced the Holocaust at such a far remove, and the confusion about exactly how we were to understand that and process that as a factor in our culture.
And this notion of redemption, and using Anne as a vehicle towards redemption, it's not just, you make the point, it's not just individuals like Mr. Roth, but it's even entire cultures and societies. This last chapter of the book is called Pawn, where Anne is used as a pawn in these political machinations. You talk about Japan, for example, and you say that the tendency to see Anne as a symbol of universal forgiveness and forgetfulness has facilitated a form of historical amnesia. What do you mean by that? And is Japan, emblematic of how other cultures and other societies have used Anne Frank as well?
That's right. I mean, surprisingly, Anne Frank is big in Japan, as we say. The diary is actually the first. It was translated in Japanese, I believe in 1952, around the same time as it was published in English. And it was the first book to talk about menstruation in such an open and direct way. So in fact, Anne has become known in Japan as a kind of symbol of a girl's first period. And her name is even a euphemism for getting your period, which is another way in which she's gone, her image has gone out in the world in which ways in which we could never have imagined. But in terms of the war, the Japanese have also a complex history to their own involvement in World War II. Of course, they were the terrible victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the atomic bombs. But they also were, part of the Axis powers allied with Hitler. There's a tendency to see Anne as a parallel figure to There's a Japanese girl named Sadako Sasaki who became a kind of a figurehead for the victims of Hiroshima. And there's a tendency to kind of pair Anne with her in Japanese culture, which, as you say, elides the way in which the Japanese were, in their own ways, implicated in World War II. But I became really fascinated researching that chapter with the many different permutations of Anne as a political figure throughout the world. And one of that I found the most inspiring was the way that she was taken up by anti-apartheid activists in South Africa in their own prison on Robben Island, which was just as isolated as Anne was in the annex. These activists, including Nelson Mandela and Ahmed Kathrada, somehow got their hands on the diary and found it an inspirational text.
Ruth Franklin, the book is called The Many Lives of Anne Frank. You write in this book that in the last decade or so, the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, which can be used as a catch-all term for criticism of Israel but often promotes the destruction of the Jewish state, has become increasingly fraught. You're on the faculty of Columbia. That was a place that, a number of very well-known protests took place. And the charge of genocide is now levied against the State of Israel itself. Having researched Anne Frank's book, how do you place Anne in that argument? How do you respond to the current climate where in so many quarters Israel has been ostracized and criticized?
Well, as I say in the book, I am extremely reluctant ever to put any to ascribe any position to Anne that she didn't herself take. And the fact is that Anne Frank was extremely apolitical and, really declined at a time when, for instance, other teenagers she knew, including her friends, were embracing Zionism as, as an exit route from persecution for the Jews of Europe. Anne wasn't really interested in it and was, preferred to be writing in her diary about, the movies and the books that she was reading. So, I'm really loath to, I think it's not quite right to speculate about what she might have thought about Zionism or anti-Zionism or, anything else that didn't really involve her. But, I think the debates around Israel's actions in Gaza and this question of genocide and where Anne falls in that, I would just say again that there's been this tension, not just around Anne's diary, but about the Holocaust in general. The question of the extent to which we see it as, an example of all genocides or as a unique and specific genocide on its own. And my answer to that, as I say in the book, is that it has to be both. Just like Anne's diary has to be both a book for everyone and also a book about the Holocaust and about anti-Semitism, we have to be able to see the Holocaust both as, a warning about all genocides in the future and as a warning about what can happen when persecution of the Jews is allowed to run unchecked.
And we will have to leave it there. This is a really, really interesting, imaginative book. I've never read a biography like this. It's just the way you've put it together and imagined it. It's really quite an intriguing read, and I learned a lot. The Many Lives of Anne Frank by Ruth Franklin. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And up next, the novelist and short story writer Amor Towles talks about his latest book, a collection of stories and a novella called Table for Two. Amor Towles joins me on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.